This week on the In-Depth Podcast, the greatest hockey player of all time, Wayne Gretzky. In our September 2016 interview, the Hall of Famer revealed the tireless work ethic that took him to the top.
I remember when I was 4 and 5 and 6, he used to have me do these stick handling drills and in and out of pylons and all that kind of stuff. But he had me doing it for hours on hours with tennis balls.
The challenges growing up as a child prodigy.
Explain why it got to a point early on you just didn't like being Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, it's like anything else, the negative people are always the loudest.
And where he found his greatest motivation.
I did always play a lot better when my dad was in the building, but it was also a sign of, geez, they don't think I'm playing well enough right now.
The great one also reflects on his retirement.
How do you replace the satisfaction?
Oh, you don't.
Now that you got...
No, you don't.
And how his son-in-law and golfer Dustin Johnson has rekindled the thrill of his playing days.
You're pulling so badly and wanting somebody to win so desperately that your stomach hurts when you're watching.
And quick story before we get going that perhaps only I find humorous. A while back, I ran into Wayne Gretzky at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. AT&T, one of the show's sponsors, by the way, just quick shout out on that front. And it was early in the morning. I was headed to breakfast. Wayne was just leaving breakfast. And I said to Wayne, hey, I don't know if you heard, we put in a request for DJ. And he's like, oh, I heard. I'm like, oh, yeah? He's like, yeah, Dustin said something to me. And I go, and? He's like, well, I told him if he's going to do it, he should do it right away. Because if not, Graham's going to drive him crazy until he finally sits down with him. Long story short, we still haven't gotten Dustin Johnson yet. I feel bad for his agent. And there you have it. Enough of me talking, and now to our chat with Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, I guess the first question I'd have for you is explain the origins of the line, failing to prepare is preparing to fail.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty simple. You know, when I was a kid, we grew up in a normal house, like everyone else. My dad was a hardworking blue-collar Bell telephone worker, and my mother was a stay-at-home mother that raised 5 children. So we didn't really have a whole lot in the sense of finances, but what we had a whole lot was tremendous support from both parents in whatever endeavors we wanted to participate in, whether it be ice hockey, baseball, box lacrosse, etc. And my dad was a big believer that that sports for kids was such a great avenue in a sense that it taught you so much about life, you know, how to work hard, how to be unselfish, how to have teammates, how to understand what losing is, understanding winning under pressure. And all those things that you do in sports are going to be part of the real world one day and part of the real life. And more importantly, he always felt that if kids participated, it kept them away from free time. And he always felt that free time was a reason for kids getting themselves into trouble and doing things they probably shouldn't be doing at 14, 15, 16. So that was his big thing. And with that, he used to say to me all the time, he didn't understand or know why I was blessed with so much God-given talent, but he really drilled into me that I was fortunate and I was lucky and not to waste it. And so practice and preparation were a huge part of what he sort of drilled into my brain from the time I was 4, 5, 6 years old. And the fortunate thing for me was I had a love and a passion. I didn't practice sort of to become the next Gordie Howe or Bobby Orr. I practiced and did the things I did because I loved it. And of course, like every other kid, you have this dream of playing in the NHL, but that dream is really tough to make into reality. So my preparation was always as good as I could make it, and always I at least knew that each and every game that I went into, I was physically and mentally going to be at the best I could possibly be at.
I want to talk to you about your dad and growing up, coming up, but I also wanted to touch on first just your playing days, and you had some kind of, it seemed like, quirks when you were playing, one of which was your pregame routine and getting dressed the same way for every game. Explain that.
Well, listen, my dad was a big believer that part of being a good athlete was not just practice and not just physically preparing, but to be mentally prepared, whether it be the proper rest the day before or the day of, proper nutrition, proper diet. He really was a big believer that if you didn't have a proper meal the night before, that physically you couldn't be at your best. And so from a young age, even at six when I was playing minor hockey, the day before and the day of, he made sure that I ate properly, and that didn't mean, you know, hot dog or French fries. That meant having either, whether it was pasta or chicken or steak or potatoes. He was a big believer in that. And so I never changed my routine my entire career, my entire life. And with that comes, you know, you can say it's superstition. You can say it's routine, how you get dressed. And I got dressed the same way all the time. I always got dressed on the right side, my right sock, my right shin pad, my right elbow pad, my right skate. Just, you know, you can say it's superstition, but it was partly routine also.
You were talking about your diet, and I mean, stats speak for themselves. You're the most dominant athlete of any sport ever. And I would have thought when, you know, reading about you, you had this, you know, really unique, specific diet. But then I saw you would sometimes have four hot dogs before a game with onions and mustard or pie or Diet Coke, or it just wasn't the diet kind of you would expect for
the normal person.
I mean, for somebody with, you know, your ability.
Well, first of all, you know, when I played junior hockey, we went to school. We went to school at 3:15, 3:30. So you don't really get a whole lot of time to eat. You race home. At that point in time, for a 7 o'clock or 7:30 game, I was eating steak and potato and all that at 4:30, 5 o'clock before I went to the arena. So when I turned pro at 17, obviously the schedule and the lifestyle is completely different. There's no school. You skate in the morning, you have a light skate to prepare for that night. And generally, guys eat somewhere between 12:30 and 1:30. And then sort of rest or sleep or nap or whatever you do to get ready for the game. But I always found that by 4:30, 5 o'clock, I was starving because my routine was I used to eat at 4:35. Mm-hmm. So I would eat at 12, 12:30 like everyone else, but I always found that by 5 o'clock, I was hungry. So depending on what city we're in, if it's Chicago, there'd be pizza in the building. If it's Quebec City, there'd be hot dogs. And some cities, it was sandwiches. And in those days, we didn't have power bars, and we didn't have Gatorade or Powerade, you know, the energy drinks. And for me, I drank Diet Coke. I found that to be the same sort of stimulation as an energy drink. And we had chocolate bars. We didn't have power bars. So if I had a Snickers or any kind of a chocolate bar, I found that that gave me energy. And sometimes it lasted throughout the game, and then other times I'd be hungry after the first period or the second period, and I'd have a half a sandwich or just something to give me that little bit of energy. And I never changed from the time I was six. So I think my body, and physically and mentally, I just got so used to it, I had to have it.
I understand when you were playing in the NHL, you could tell if the stick was an eighth of an inch shorter or a quarter of an ounce off, or the Bauer skate blades were just minimally different. How true is that?
Well, it's pretty true. It's like, you know, anything else becomes second nature to you because that's your life. I mean, I was in skates as much as I was in probably walking shoes. I was holding a hockey stick as much as I was wearing a toque. You just get so comfortable and so used to it. And, you know, it's no different than probably a baseball player, you know, George Brett, the feel of his baseball bat. Whether it's a guy like Jack Nicklaus with his golf club, you know, if you do it every single day and you grow up doing it all the time, it just becomes second nature to you. And it's not something that I consider and say I'm an expert on, but I was an expert on my own equipment and what I felt comfortable with, whether it was my skates, my shin pads, my hockey stick. Consequently, you get so used to it that if there's any kind of a minimal change, it's recognizable and so kind of throws you off.
Although when you were 5 years old, you could have played against the 10 years 10-year-olds, you were prevented from doing so. So at 6 years old, you were playing against the 10-year-olds. At 14 years old, you were playing against, I think, some 20-year-olds. What do you think allowed you to do that?
Oh, first of all, when I was five, when I tried out for the team, in those days, minor hockey, I think it's called Adam now, it was called novice. That was the first team you played on, 9 and 10-year-olds. So if I was going to make a team, a travel team, that was the team I had to make.
What are they saying when a little five-year-old shows up to practice?
Well, I think they were in shock because I actually made the team. I just think they thought I was a smaller player because when they asked my dad for my birth certificate, they kind of chuckled and said, well, you know, he can't play. He's too young, which was pretty unique. And I can remember it was like almost like it was yesterday, my dad and I sitting there and said, you can't play. So there was some discussion. There was a little town about 10 minutes outside of our town that I could have played on that team. But I played on that team at five, I would have had to stay on that team throughout my minor hockey career. And at 5 and 6 and 7, it would have been okay. But, you know, by the time I got older, it wouldn't have been the right fit for me because they were basically a level below my hometown. So basically went from double A, I would have been playing A hockey, which wouldn't have been good for me. So we chose to not play that year. I went back the next year and I made the team. And probably the success I had on that team, and I didn't play a lot, I scored one goal. It wasn't like I dominated and lit it up, but I scored one goal my first year. I think that was the stepping stone for my life, in the sense that at six I was playing with 10-year-olds and against 10-year-olds who are much stronger and faster, bigger. And so I had to use my hockey sense and my hockey knowledge. And obviously, as you grow in age, it becomes even better and more aware. So when I was 14 and they said, you know, you can play, come and play on this junior team. And I went and watched a practice. And I was really unsure, to be honest. I didn't know if I could sustain and play against 18, 19, 20-year-olds. The coach actually talked me into it and said, you could play at this level and I want you to be part of this. And so a lot like when I was six playing against the 10-year-olds, I had to use my hockey knowledge and my hockey sense because, again, I wasn't as physically strong. I wasn't as big or fast. A junior B coach that I had at that time was the guy who really changed my career in a sense that he was the guy that told me to watch Bobby Clark play. And in those days, the centermen were guys like Phil Esposito and John Beliveau, and they were sort of this big, rugged, strong centermen that could consequently stand in the middle of the ice and stand in front of the goalie and not get pushed around. When you're my size, at junior B, I think I was 5'7" and 115 pounds. I was a little guy. And it was him that encouraged me to watch Bobby Clark because Bobby Clark wasn't known to be a big guy at the time playing in the NHL and winning MVPs and Stanley Cups and scoring titles. So that's when I changed my whole game and started playing out of the corner and playing behind the net, which was relatively new for anybody to defend against because nobody really ever gone behind the net. Everything used to be in front of the net. I sort of worked on that for 2 years as a junior, and then I went and played Major Junior A in Sault Ste. Marie and continued on playing from sort of the corner and behind the net and sort of perfected it. By the time I got to Edmonton and the WHA, it was something that I was very comfortable with, and yet for people defending me, nobody had really seen that a whole lot because everything used to transpire from the blue line to the front of the net. So I was able to grow my game, use my hockey sense, and practice what made me the player I became by starting doing it at the age of 14, and that was something that really helped me throughout my entire career.
Explain what you would do when watching a game on television as a kid with drawing the rink on a piece of paper and how that benefited you.
Well, my dad was always a really strong thinker of the game. I remember when I was 4 and 5 and 6, he used to have me do these stick handling drills and in and out of pylons and all that kind of stuff. But he had me doing it for hours on hours with tennis balls. And his theory was that the tennis ball would bounce a little bit more than the puck. So if you could control a tennis ball, you're going to be so much more comfortable and be so much more at ease stick handling and carrying a puck. So for hours and hours, I would skate and do drills with tennis balls at a young age. And then watching the games, he used to say to me, look, you know, what you should do is take out a big diagram and build the rink, and you should watch the game. And by watching the game and not looking down, you're going to create some more peripheral vision, and you're going to grow your sense of where the puck is on the ice at all times. And so I would sit there every game, basically, when I was a youngster, and follow the puck without looking down onto the sheet. And as time went on, obviously, I got better and better at it. Probably was drawn on the floor half the time at the beginning, but as time went on, I sort of mastered it pretty well.
Tell about Wally Coliseum mm-hmm. and why you used to pretend that was Maple Leafs Garden.
You know, as kids, we all dreamed of one day playing in Maple Leaf Gardens. It was like our sort of church. It was our everything if you were a hockey player. My first game I ever went to, 1968 or 69, I was with my grandmother, and we sat in the very last row of Maple Leaf Gardens. And we got there at 7 o'clock and watched the warm-up. I watched the game, I watched the three stars, and I just kept thinking how great it was and how wonderful it was. And yet we sat in the very last row, but I still loved every second of it and can remember it was like it was yesterday. And so that really, those kind of things really inspired me to one day dream big of wanting to play in the NHL. And so my whole belief was that I had a love and a passion. I truly enjoyed just skating by myself in the backyard for hours on hours. And I never looked at it like I was practicing or I was becoming a better player. I looked at it that was my thrill, and that was my fun, that I really truly could just skate out there by myself for hours on hours. And for whatever reason, nobody could understand it, but that was my fun.
And your dad had a unique way of making the mm-hmm. hockey rink in the backyard.
He always built one of the best outdoor rinks around. He always had the ice 4.5-5 inches thick, and you know, he would begin by just watering it like everybody else, but he would take a sprinkler head at nights, and he'd have the sprinkler head going for a couple hours, and consequently always had the best ice around.
How would you best explain the role your dad played in your life?
Well, it was everything. My mom and dad were they're the reason that I made the NHL. You know, fathers get most credit for athletes, and deservingly so, they get a lot of the credit. But, you know, my mother was probably as important, or maybe even more important, in the sense that she was the foundation of our family and of our household. But my dad always said, the good Lord has blessed you for whatever reason. You're getting a great opportunity to get out and see the world and create some great memories and some great thrills in your lifetime, and I'd hate to see you sort of throw it away. And so he always encouraged me. He was always at practice. He was at every game. You know, people say, was he tough on you? He wasn't tough on me, but, you know, if I did things that he felt weren't going to make me or benefit me as an athlete, he would sort of give me the ins and outs of why he thought it wasn't proper. And I remember the biggest lesson, or one of the biggest lessons I ever learned, was the year I scored the 400 goals. I was a kid that, as soon as hockey season was over, I couldn't wait for baseball and box lacrosse. And basically, I took my equipment and I threw it downstairs at the end of sort of middle of April, and didn't get it back up there until Labor Day. I never skated in the off season, never went to hockey schools. I didn't do any of that. I guess they probably call it cross training now, but back in those days, it was just like, all right, I'm going to do track now. I'm going to do baseball.
And your dream was being a Detroit Tigers player,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, I loved baseball as much or more than I even enjoyed the game of hockey. So it was about 3 or 4 days after our season had ended, and one of the towns, which was a half hour from our town that we never really played against for whatever reason, they wanted to play an exhibition game. And so the coach came over and he said, you know, we'll play this game as long as Wayne's going to play. If Wayne doesn't play, you know, we're not going to do the game. And so my dad said, do you want to play? And I said, yeah, okay, I'll play. And we got beat 8-1. It wasn't a very good game by any means. And I remember we got in the car and my dad said, you know, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, what are you going to do? Last game, we lost 8-1. It's not a real big deal. And, you know, in a nice way, my dad said to me, you know, you can't be like that. And I remember thinking, what do you mean? He said, you ruined your whole year. I said, how could I ruin my whole year? And he said, for whatever reason, the good Lord has chosen you. And each and every time you play, people want to see what the fuss and what everything is all about. And you can't afford not to be ready to play the best you can play each and every night. And so it was a lesson I learned because as I went on and started playing with the Oilers, I prepared for each and every game like it was a Stanley Cup final game, whether it was an exhibition game in the end of September or game 7 of the Stanley Cup playoffs in May. I know in my heart that I physically and mentally did the best I could to play as good as I could play that night.
I think it was when you were with the Oilers, if there was an important game coming up, sometimes they would call your dad to try and get him to come to the game because they believed you just played even a little better when your father was in attendance.
It was always a catch-22 because when I would come out for the morning skate, if I saw my dad, obviously I was thrilled he was there, and I did always play a lot better when my dad was in the building, but it was also a sign of, okay, geez, they don't think I'm playing well enough right now. I better get going. So it was kind of a catch-22. It was a little bit of a kick in the butt also.
So in 1991, later on, your father suffers a near-fatal brain aneurysm. How did you find out?
We were actually playing that night, and as my routine was, it was, you know, I ate lunch around 12:15, and I generally lied down for an hour and a half. Sometimes I slept, sometimes I didn't. And generally I got up around 3 o'clock and got dressed and went to the arena. What had transpired at that moment was around 1 o'clock, I could hear my wife running up the stairs and, you know, kind of flew open the door. And, you know, for people who are with around the athletes, they understand that there's sort of an hour and a half period there, everybody's quiet and nobody wakes anybody up because they're getting ready. But it was obviously pretty quick and loud and running through, and she said, yes, your dad's in the hospital. And so we got on a plane that day, and I missed the game that night, and we flew home. And, you know, it's an amazing story because, you know, my dad worried about everything that transpired in his entire family, his friends, and part of, you know, any kind of injury like that is a lot to do with stress. And for my dad, he was, I think, 7 days basically in a coma and 2 or 3 years in a clinic, maybe even 4 years in a clinic. And then the last year when they released him, he was at home and we used to have signs in the house for him to remember where the washroom was and where the kitchen was. And it's an amazing story because if you saw my dad today, you wouldn't even know he had an injury. And, you know, it's probably added 20, 25 years to his life because as the case for a lot of people in the 50s and early 60s, a lot of people smoked and it was part of our society. And, you know, he smoked probably a pack of cigarettes a day. Since his brain aneurysm, obviously he hasn't had a cigarette and he hasn't smoked. And because of that, he's probably lived 20, 25 years longer. So in life, everything happens for a reason. he's one of the most renowned Canadians in Canadian history because, you know, he's good to everybody. And people in Canada understand and realize that he's just got a big heart. And for my dad, his riches are his family and friends. And money's never been a big issue with my dad.
When he first came out of the operation, he was speaking Ukrainian, the first language he learned, didn't know how to tie his shoes or open a door, didn't recognize you or any of your siblings. What did that recovery process entail for him?
You know, once he got through that sort of 4-year period and then they started to wean him off of the drugs that he had to take to prevent further, you know, heart attacks or aneurysms. Once he sort of started coming off of that medication, you could see the energy level and his personality start to come back. But, the good things, like I said, you know, he quit smoking, and I think he's more at ease. He doesn't worry so much about the wins and losses when I was playing or when I was coaching or part of a team. He enjoys it when we win, but he doesn't stress like he used to stress over it. That, you know, there was games where he would basically leave the arena and kind of go outside because he couldn't watch sometimes because it was so stressful for him.
How much do you think your parents sacrificed to support hockey?
Yeah, everything. My dad couldn't afford a new pair of skates for me. One of my grandparents inevitably helped out. Every now and then an uncle or cousin would help out. We didn't go on family vacations because we really couldn't afford it. Our family vacations were going to hockey games and baseball games. But we didn't want for anything else. That was our life, and we loved every minute of it. But yeah, you know, we're no different than 1,000 other stories of kids in North America or even Europe that came over that made the NHL that didn't have as much as other kids. But we were rich in support and love, and to me that meant more than financial dollars.
So a year earlier, I think you're getting paid $5 an hour filling potholes right. with gravel, and then all of a sudden you sign a multi-year contract where you get a $250,000 signing bonus plus another $100,000 in the first year. What does your dad say to you when you ask for some money from that to buy a car?
You know, it's an interesting, because when I was a kid, you know, 12 and 13 and 14, and I understood that we didn't have a whole lot, but that was okay. I didn't want for anything, but I can remember sort of 12, 13, 14 saying, should I get a summer job? And my dad always said, no, you know, you got your whole life to work. When you're a kid, be a kid. But if you're gonna be a kid and train and be the best athlete you can be, that's your responsibility, and make sure you don't fake it. Make sure you put in the time. And so I always thought that. And then when I turned 16, I remember he said, okay, you can work this summer. I remember I got a job. I think I was making about $4 an hour. But I really enjoyed it. I was throwing gravel onto to holes on the roads and highways, and somebody else would tar it. And I remember thinking, well, why can't I tar it? Why do I have to throw the gravel? But I worked for about 8 weeks, and I remember with my last day, I remember my dad saying to me, I guess you want to become a professional hockey player. I said, yeah, I guess I do. But it was a great learning experience for me. I'm glad I did it. And, you know, obviously it encouraged me to become the best athlete I could become. Yeah, and like everyone else, I was in shock, and I didn't see that coming when Nelson Skelbania and WHA came along and offered me this ransom of money, and I didn't anticipate it. So when I did sign, I remember I said, I got to buy a car. I'd just gotten my license because my dad wouldn't let me get my driver's license till I was 17. So I'd just gotten it in about February or March of that year. And I remember saying to my dad, I need to buy a car. And he said, all right, here's $5,000, get whatever you can. So I bought an old used Trans Am, and I think I paid $3,600 for it, but I was more happy than anybody.
The 1987 Canada Cup, you went off apparently on Mario Lemieux in practice one day. Explain the situation and why you did it.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Players who know me and know that I've played with them, I don't think I've ever gone off on anybody, except when Marty stole my Diet Cokes here and there. You know, Mario was a young kid, and as I was in 1981, you know, you're in awe. And I was in awe, and so probably was Mario in 87. We didn't play together the first four or five games, and we were really bad. Not really bad, but we weren't what we were supposed to be. It was supposed to be this big buildup. It was going to be Canada against Russia in the finals, or at that time, the Soviet Union. And we had stumbled along for 2.5, 3 weeks in this tournament. We had a big powwow, myself and Mark Messier and Ray Bourque, with, at that time, I think the GMs were Bobby Clark and Serge Savard and Cliff Fletcher. Talked about what we can do to make it more comfortable and make things better. And so we were able to do that, and at the arena the next day, Mike had called us in and said, you know, I'm going to play you and Mario together. And I said, that's fine. And so what had happened was the first game we played together, him and I got a two-on-one, and I gave him a pass. And Mario's got such great hands, like Mike Bossy or Brett Hall. He never misses. And he passed it back to me. Now, although I was a goal scorer and scored a lot of goals, quite frankly, I would tell you that, you know, Mario's got an opportunity to snap a puck from the slot. His shot is probably harder and better than mine. And consequently, I wanted him to be the shooter. So when we got back to the bench, I said, listen, Mario, you know, if we ever get two-on-ones, you know, just believe me, you're going to be the shooter. You're going to score the goal because, quite frankly, you're a better goal scorer than I am. And so that was the conversation I really had with him. And what made that such a big story was ultimately how we won the final game when we had a two-on-one and I gave him the pass. And I knew when I gave him the pass, I was never going to get it back. And I remember saying to him when he scored the goal, I said, oh my gosh, that was one of the greatest goals I was ever part of.
And Coach Mike Keenan credits that as the tournament where Mario really became the player that he ultimately...
He would have been the player he became. Obviously, like me in 81, when you're around guys like Guy Lafleur and Robinson and guys like that, you become a better player. And you watch how they practice and you watch how they became winners. And, you know, sometimes you got to see it firsthand in order to really comprehend it. Pure talent and ability just doesn't do that. You got to see, you got to gain this knowledge. And so I got it in 81, and Mark Messier got big parts of it also, and guys like that. And then Mario was the benefactor of that in 87 and became, helped make him or help become the player he became. But listen, Marlon Mew was still one of the greatest players who ever lived. I think he would have been fine had he not been there in 87.
Yeah, right. So after you won your fourth Stanley Cup in 5 years, what's the shocking news your dad ends up telling you that night?
Obviously, you know, we were the best team that year, and we basically won four straight in the final, and we had a really strong, solid group of guys. Fortunate enough to play with so many Hall of Famers and so many great unselfish players, and it was exciting. And to win the fourth time, it never gets monotonous, although we were saying, well, this is something we could get used to. And it was obviously very exciting. And I remember by the fourth time you win the Stanley Cup, everything sort of changes. And I don't mean this to be egotistical, but you win the first Stanley Cup, everybody sort of is helter-skelter. Nobody really knows what's going on or where do you go or who takes the cup. By the fourth cup, everything's sort of more mellow and much more organized, and you know, players are a little bit more subdued, although obviously really excited. And so we had, I think we had like a big family, friends, team sort of get together dinner. And it was at that point in time, my dad sort of whispered in my ear that there had been talk that, you know, teams were maybe going to trade for me. And I thought he's out of his mind, and I didn't believe that was realistic. And so that was the end of it. And, you know, as the night went on, we went home, and I got a phone call at home. In those days, people had phones in their houses. I had a phone call from the first contract that I was ever offered by Nelson Skobania, and he asked me how I'd like to become a Vancouver Canuck and be part owner. And I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. So once he made that call, I knew there was some sort of traction to the story, and I knew there was something behind it.
What do you remember from being in the office of the then Kings owner when the Oilers owner calls and doesn't know you're in the office?
No, he basically said I was like every other player and he was going to trade me because I wasn't going to sign a contract with him. And that sort of probably elevated my level of, okay, we got to move on here and I'm gonna get traded. And at that point in time, I, like every athlete, you think that you're untouchable in a franchise, but he looked at me as one of 20 players, and I understood that now. At that time, I didn't understand it at all. You know, business is business, and, you know, I felt that, you know, obviously the biggest reason I got traded is that I wouldn't sign an extension. And it wasn't that I wouldn't sign, it was more on the basis of, look, let me play the year out, and at the end of the year, we'll, whatever fair market value is, I don't want to go anywhere, quite frankly. And from his side of things, he didn't want that to happen. He said, basically, if you don't sign, you know, I got to move you. At that point in time, obviously, I didn't understand it, partly because I was younger and, quite frankly, didn't understand that side of the business.
And, I mean, it seemed like you kind of went out of your way to be overly nice with how you handled things in that press conference where the trade was...
Well, because I was treated incredibly well, not only by the organization and not only by ownership and the coaches. I mean, they were hard on me. The coaches got to be hard on you. That's what makes you a better athlete. There were some times I wasn't too happy about that, but that's what made me the player I became. But all in all, the memories and the friendships I had and the people I met in Edmonton, the fans I've met, it was hard. It was difficult for when they told me, okay, and we're going to trade him. We basically, he's out of here. And that was difficult for me. It was Glenn Saylor was the one guy, though, that tried to talk me out of it. And he was the one guy that said, I can stop this and I can kill this. Basically stepped in and said all that. But by that point in time, I felt like that ship had sailed.
After you were traded, I think the Oilers owner suggested publicly that your tears in the press conference were fake.
Well, again,
did it bother you?
Oh,
like,
sure.
How it
crushed me.
All ended?
Yeah, it crushed me. And probably I said some things about him or to him that crushed him because the emotions were really high. But, you know, he went through a hard, difficult time when he traded me, and he probably knew more than anybody how hard it was going to be. So he's defending himself and his integrity. Now I look back at it, I understand it. I understand where he's coming from. At the time, I didn't have a whole lot of sympathy for it, but at this point in time in my life, you know, I understand the entire package.
To what extent were you surprised by how severe the public reaction
was? I wasn't surprised because, you know, Edmontonians treated me like a son. I always say that, you know, Mark Messier is an Edmonton boy and he's their son. And I was from Toronto area and I was their adopted son. I made so many friendships and I like to think we gave them a lot of great memories. One of the things that is kind of funny now when I go to Edmonton periodically, people will say, you know, my grandparents told me you were a pretty good player. They used to watch you play, and I think, oh, my God, how old am I getting? Used to be, you know, I saw you play, or my kids saw you play. Now it's, my grandparents said you were pretty good. So I got treated so well there. Never had a problem or an issue. Nobody treated me any different than anyone else in that city. People would say to me all the time, how did you get around? Where did you go? I went everywhere. Nobody ever bothered me. Sure, people wanted autographs or the odd picture, but nobody ever bugged me to a point where I'd say, I can't go there, there's too many people. I went to theaters, I went to movies, I went to junior hockey games and sat in the stands. People treated me just incredibly well, and that was the hardest part about leaving, is I was treated so well.
And you received an amazing standing ovation the first time you came back to play the Oilers in Edmonton. What you said the hardest thing you ever had to do in hockey was play the Oilers.
Yeah. Listen, the first game I went back was so difficult. Because first and foremost, the guys on the other team, we'd won championships together, we were best friends together, we saw families grow together, our parents were all best friends. Secondly, Edmonton's different than most cities, and that's not a big, huge city. So 90% of the games, it was the same people sitting in the same seats. I could look across the ice and for four people sitting there, I saw those same four people almost 35 out of 40 games. So they became like friends, not just fans, they became friends. So going in there, and they treated me well, and I like to think I played hard for them, so it was a two-way street. So going in there, I knew it was gonna be the hardest thing I ever did. And so the first game was relatively, not easy, but it was nice because there was a lot of niceties that went with that first time back. After that, for me, it was the hardest place I ever played in. I hated it, never liked it, never got over it. From the first game to the last game, the last shift I played there, I just was never very comfortable at ever being an opponent playing in Edmonton.
What's this I hear that you proposed over the phone?
Yeah, you know, sort of Jackie Robinson. I saw that in this movie. We were in Edmonton together, and she was going to do this video for a workout video, and she was going to be gone for 5 or 6 weeks. And it was just one of those things where when you're chatting on the phone, basically was like, well, why don't we get married? And so we just said, yeah, why wait? And we did it over the phone, obviously. And when she came back to Edmonton, obviously we had a proper dinner and proper event to get ready. But it was interesting. I had really not told anybody, and I told one of my teammates one night, and one of the waiters, I guess, overheard it. And it was the next morning, it was on the news, and I said, oh my God, how'd this get on the news? And you could call into the radio station for the biggest tip of the day or the biggest tip of the month, and this guy won. I said, I hope you win tip of the year. It's worth it. So anyway, that's kind of how it leaked out. We didn't plan on it leaking out till she got back, but it happened.
How true is it that, I mean, something like 10,000 people were outside the chapel in which
you got married? Well, first of all, you got to understand, it's a huge hockey city. It's a huge sports city. So the people that we had at the wedding, the people who were going to be there, obviously a lot of the Oilers players, some NHL guys, people like Gordie Howe and Vladislav Tretiak, people who are my friends that over the years. And Edmontonians love hockey and they want to see them. And so part of the attraction was for people to see these different athletes and celebrities that might be at the wedding. And then, of course, the wedding itself. So, you know, again, nobody bothered me. Nobody got in the way. People were genuinely nice. People were very appreciative. And it was one of those, it was a beautiful day for not only myself, but for my grandmothers who were both there. And obviously my mom and dad and Janet's mom. It was
it looked like a royal wedding.
No, it wasn't quite.
But I mean, that's what it.
But it was fun. Right. We, you know, I had done so many favors in town for different charity events and stuff like that. So, you know, people that I had done favors for in the years sort of stepped up, and like the Edmonton Orchestra said, we want to play in the church, and a couple of my friends said, we want to sing, and the people who donated a couple old cars to take the wedding party away where people I'd done charity events for in town donated their cars. So it became like a city event in that everybody was sort of involved because it is a small community and everybody helps each other. Turned out to be a wonderful day.
Although I don't think she remembers it, you and your now wife Janet first met, I think, in 1981 at Dance Fever, and then you guys later had a chance to talk at a Lakers-Celtics game, during which you asked her, I think, to grab like beers after the game. Is it true, like that night, you knew you were in love with her?
Well, I don't know if that night, but yeah, we got along very well the very first time. We sort of sat and actually chatted with each other, and our, you know, mindset was very similar, and our goals were the same in life, in that, you know, family was number one importance, and our careers were important, but, you know, we both wanted to have kids and a family. So when you start off a night where you're both on the same page, obviously it makes life that much more simple. It was true. We met in 81. I did this show called Dance Fever, and obviously she's a tremendous dancer, and she was really good at it, and I was a horrible dancer, and it's probably one of the most feared moments I had in my life is, you know, you had to walk out on stage and dance for like 8 seconds, and it was... She one time asked me what happens to my rhythm when I take my skates off, and I said, I really don't know, but...
So how'd you do?
I did awful, but, you know, and then you were to judge these kids who were dancing, and of course, I was going to give every one of them a 10 no matter what, because I don't know anything about dancing, so I did. I think I gave everybody a 10, but that's when we first met, and then over the years, I think we ran into each other a couple of times at different charity events, and then... We went to the Lakers-Celtic game. We were both big basketball fans in the sense that we loved watching the Celtic-Laker final like everyone else, and we just happened to be at the same game. She was with a friend, and I was with Alan Thick, and we ended up going for a bite to eat after, and the rest is history.
Your daughter's soon-to-be husband's PGA Tour star, Dustin Johnson. What's it like having another professional athlete in the family?
Yeah, obviously he's at a whole different level in his career right now. He's been a wonderful father, and he's been tremendous to have around our family, and we like to think we've helped him a little bit. But we never thought, or I never thought once I retired, that I'd have the same sense or the same feeling going into tournaments, that you're pulling so badly and wanting somebody to win so desperately that your stomach hurts when you're watching. And it's probably the same feeling that my wife and my dad had when they watched me play hockey games when we're in the championship games.
Really? You feel the same way watching him?
Sometimes I have to turn away if he's got a putt, or sometimes, you know, I get nervous if he's got a shot, you know, but that's because you want someone to do so well. That's because you're pulling for them so badly that you get this anxiety inside you that you want them to be so successful. And listen, he's an elite athlete. He's an elite golfer, obviously. And he's got the ability to go to even another level, I believe, and good for him.
Much like anybody at points in their life, he went through some tough times in 2014. And he has publicly said you were one of the key people in his life then, and has been very complimentary of your role in all of that. What was important to you to pass along during that period?
Listen, in life, nobody's perfect. And, you know, everyone has, some point in time in their life, come to that sort of fork in the road where you got to make a decision. Okay, is this what I really want to do, or am I happy sort of bumping along? And I think for Dustin, that's really what happened to him. He got to a point in his life where he said, you know what, I don't want to just be an average player. I want to be the best player I can become. And from my point of view and Janet's point of view, we just gave him sort of that support and that belief that every athlete needs. I don't care which athlete you are, even the greatest athletes in the world have to have that confidence. And if you don't have that confidence, then it doesn't matter how talented you are. And I think he really came to that realization on his own. And from what I saw and from what I know of him and being around him, and obviously I was around him a lot, I think really his life changed more so than being around Janet and I and Paulina. When he was disappointed he didn't make the President's Cup team, I believe in 2013, when he was ninth player and he didn't get picked. He wasn't a captain's pick. And I think that really shook him up to a point where, as Janet had said to him one night, you know, don't put your fate in anybody else's hands. Control your own destiny. And I think that's when he really made the decision as a professional athlete, I'm going to control my own destiny from now on. And from that point on, he just became a different, probably, person and a more complete golfer than he is today. He's a special athlete. More importantly, we love him to death. He's just a wonderful young man.
Which has to make the success he's now having all the sweeter.
Oh, it's so much fun because we personally saw the effort and the work and the commitment that he's put into it, and the time. There's a lot of great athletes in the world. And, you know, my dad always said, no matter how good you think you are, there's somebody out there that's better than you are. So you better be ready the best you can possibly be, or you're going to be on the receiving end of that loss. And I think for Dustin, everyone knew how good he was. And I think that the last person maybe to understand and realize to what level he could get to is maybe himself. And
why do you think that was?
Some people just takes longer to learn. Every athlete's different. Some athletes learn it at 20. Some athletes learn it at 25. Some athletes learn it at 30. And I just think from his point of view, he just finally said, okay, I'm not going to be content winning once a year. I want to go out there and win a lot. And I think he's put in so much work now, not just from the golf, but physically getting ready to play golf. He's in better shape than he's ever been in. And as I told him in Pittsburgh this year, when he's played so well and won the U.S. Open, physically, that's about as good a shape as I've ever seen him in. He's always been known to be in great shape as an athlete. And I think he's even gone to another level now.
What do you think the difference is, speaking to dominance and then your dominance when you were playing, what do you think the difference is between great and the best?
Oh, it's a fine line, but I think I say this a lot. The greatest athletes who ever played in any sport that they're in save their best for the most crucial and most pressure scenario. And I always relate to when I was a younger kid and a guy that was a fan of every sport and watched other athletes. And I always said this, that if it was game 7 of a baseball game, you could not get George Brett out. George Brett was the greatest clutch hitter I ever saw as a baseball player. If it was game 7 of NBA finals, you wanted to see Larry Bird and Magic Johnson play because they both could dominate. I thought that John McEnroe, the bigger the game, the bigger the tennis match, the different level that he would go to. And more importantly, those players loved it. You could see by the look in their eyes and in their faces, it wasn't work to them. That's when they were having their most fun, and that's when they were having their most enjoyment, was the bigger the game and the bigger the situation, the next level that they would rise to. And for me, that's what I've always admired, and that's why I've always said, that guy's a good player, but that guy's a great player.
And you hold, obviously, so many NHL records, and I think probably what's most impressive isn't the number of records, but the gap between you and the person who's second. Maybe the most amazing stats that if you took away all your NHL goals, you would still be the leader in points in the NHL. But I was interested to read you a quote that somebody said and get your thoughts, and it's that, quote, "I always say he's the greatest player ever because he wasn't strong. As a matter of fact, he was kind of weak. He wasn't fast. He was just an average skater. His shot wasn't that great. He wasn't quick. There was no one thing you could point at and say that's what makes him great, but he could put it all together like nobody else could." What do you think?
Who said that?
Hockey commentator.
My dad?
Yeah. No.
Well, listen, it goes back to what I said from the very beginning. When I was six, I never changed my style of play. And I was fortunate enough that I worked on my craft from the time I was 5 years old to the time I retired at 39. And I knew what I had. I wasn't fast, and I wasn't strong, and I didn't have the hardest shot. But he's right. I did put it together in a sense that if there was a loose puck, I could get to a loose puck. My ability to have tremendous balance on my skates, I was hard to knock off the puck because I had great balance. Shooting the puck, I didn't necessarily have the hardest shot, but I could tell you, I could hit the exact spot that I wanted to shoot the puck to. So for me, those things all made me the player that I was. And then the preparation for a game, I said this recently, we were really well coached in Edmonton, and yet I think that one of the big pluses for the Oilers and for the organization was that guys like myself and Mark Messier and Glenn Anderson and Yuri Curry and Paul Coffey, all guys who became Hall of Famers, we were like sponges. We wanted to be directed, and we wanted to be coached, and we wanted to be told, and we listened to it. And we took that direction as, this is going to make us a better team and better players. And so all that cultivated into what we became, and I like to think that we were all a big part of that. And the era I played in, let's face it, I came in at the right time. And timing in life is a big part of it, too. There was 21-team league when I came in. Probably would have been very difficult for me to make a 6-team league. I got 1 year sort of a stepping stone where I played in that WHA that wasn't as good as the NHL, but it was better than the American League level, so that helped me. The game is different today. These players are bigger, they're faster, they're stronger, the goaltending's different. Who knows if I could even have played in this era, but I'd like to think that somehow I would have found a way.
Right. Explain why it got to a point early on,
13, 14
years old, where you just didn't like being Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was a question. I didn't like being Wayne Gretzky. I didn't like being everything that went on about around being Wayne Gretzky, in that sense that the kids were great. You know, listen, when you're a little town, it's all the same kids on the ball team. It's mostly all the same kids on the hockey team and a lot of the same kids on the box lacrosse team. So there was a good 10 or 11 of the 15 on each team that just played together on every team. So the kids and I were fine, like I said. And as time went on, parents, you know, would get envious. And, you know, some of the coaches I had at 13, 14 were didn't like maybe the style of play that I played.
And although it might have only been a few people, what were they saying?
It's like anything else. The negative people are always the loudest. Mm-hmm. That I was overrated and I was spoiled and I'm not going to make it past 15. And so I remember out of the blue, I got this phone call from a friend that I'd known forever. And he said, "How would you like to play in Toronto?" And I said, "Absolutely, I'm in." So I said to my dad, after he called me, I said, hey, I'm going to go play in Toronto. And my dad kind of laughed. But as time went on that summer, he came down a couple times and explained to my dad what would be good for me. And as time went on, my dad started really thinking, okay, this might be the right thing to do. Let him kind of go be a normal high school student and normal kid and playing. And my dad really felt that I would struggle, but be more of an average player playing in Toronto where there's so many good players and so many good teams. I think he felt like it would obviously, progress me and make me a better player, but that I'd be more like one of the players instead of this sort of spotlight kid. And I think ultimately he just said, this is probably the right thing to do.
And this was an hour away from home.
It was an hour away from home, and it was tough. The first 3 months or 4 months was really difficult. I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Well, you were, I think, crying a lot.
Yeah.
And how hard was it not only on you but your parents to make the decision to let you go?
Now I look back at it and I understand how difficult it was for them. It was probably harder for them than it was even for me. Because then I obviously went through it with my own kids. You have your kids and you want them home all the time. So, I understood it was probably harder for them. It's probably even more difficult for my mom than even my dad. But turned out to be probably the best thing I ever did in my life and probably the most important thing I ever did, because I became much more of a normal child and blended in. People I went to high school the first year I was there didn't even know I played ice hockey.
Except I think there was a moment, and this might have been later on, but I thought this was interesting. You score 4 goals in a game, and one of your Toronto friends just unknowingly goes to the game and comes up to you the next day asking if that's you, and what do you say?
Well, it was ironic because to this day I'm still friends with him, and he was my closest friend in high school. And I didn't know a lot of kids there because I just moved to Toronto. It was a big city and big school. I think we had 900 kids in our school. And we became friends, but he never played hockey, and he was a football player, and I never played football, obviously, and I didn't know much about it. And he didn't know much about hockey, but one of his brother's friends was playing junior A hockey. So he went to see the game. It was a playoff game, and I actually played in the game. I think I scored 3 goals that night. And he asked me the next day at school, he said, was that you? And I said, yeah, but don't tell anybody. But the secret kind of got out of the bag a couple months later.
But you were kind of being serious. You just didn't want that attention
because I was really enjoying. I really enjoyed myself in high school as just a normal 14-year-old that was going to high school. I had created some friends there and good friendships, and I was having fun at school, and I was enjoying the people I was around, and people really didn't look at me as this person who was in newspapers every day and media every day. So anyway, I ended up, after that first year, obviously people started to be aware of who I was.
And I think it was the day before your final game, the Rangers owner offers you a check for $1 million just to consider playing another year. You could have kept $1 million had you considered it and said...
Probably the dumbest thing I've ever done, right? Without question. I always tell people this. There's nothing like playing in Manhattan. It really is special. And the Ranger organization is one of the greatest organizations, all of pro sports. And the Dolan family were nothing but just incredible, not only to me, but to my family and my wife. And the day before I was announcing my retirement, Mr. Dolan said, just give it 7 days, and you still want to retire in 7 days, you can keep the money. And I said to him, I said, in good conscience, I just can't take your money because I know I'm done. But that's how classy their organization was. They were just, I can't say enough good things about him personally and about that organization.
At any point since you've retired, has the thought of coming back crossed your mind?
Never. Geez, I think one time about 2 or 3 years after I was retired, I was training at this fitness institute in Phoenix. And I was training pretty hard. It was like 3 hours a day, and I was doing it with a couple of the young Coyote players, and I was really having fun. And I remember it was about 4 weeks into it. After the second day, I was so sore, I had to get a massage for 2 hours because my body was so sore from not having done it for like 2 or 3 years. And I started getting phone calls from some Canadian media friends like, hey, what are you doing? And I said, trust me, I am not coming back. That's not part of the plan. I'm just doing this for fun. I'm doing it to get in shape. I'm really enjoying myself. I'm 42 years old. That's not the recipe for a comeback in this day and age. So I never crossed my mind to come back. Although I would tell you, people say to me, do you miss it? And I say, absolutely. I wish I could still play. I wish I could be out there. Unfortunately, as a professional athlete, at the age of 40, you're an old man, but in the real world, you're a youngster. So do I miss it? Immensely. And do I wish I could still play? Yeah, but I know I'm not good enough to play. And so for me, periodically, whether it's once or twice a year, I'll play. But to play just every day in old-timer games, that's not for me.
When you retired from hockey as player and even later as an owner and coach, you were still, by all standards, a young man.
Mm-hmm.
How do you replace the satisfaction
now
that you got from
the
game?
No, you don't. I tell people this all the time. There's no way to replace the high and the excitement and enthusiasm I had as a professional hockey player. That's, without question, not replaceable. So you can't even try to. And if you try to, you're in trouble. The closest thing you can get to is you, like my mom and dad, you live your life through your kids. You know, whatever your kids are doing, you pull for them and you support them and you pray for them and you want them to succeed. And that's your high and that's your excitement and that's your enthusiasm. So that's kind of how you look for your vice, but nothing replaces the thrill of playing hockey.
What was involved with writing the book, 99?
So, you know, for me, the people who know me, there's nothing in life I love more than the game of hockey. I mean, I know everything about the game. I grew up studying it. I idolized it. I used to go to the Hockey Hall of Fame and walk around for hours and hours just staring at equipment and players and names and stories. And so I just felt like, you know what, this is the 99th anniversary of the National Hockey League. Let's do something real fun and talk about the NHL. And so it's basically broken down in different elements, sort of the early years of the National Hockey League and sort of how it started and how we went from two periods to three periods, how the All-Star game sort of started and came about. And then to me as sort of a youngster, growing up and going to my first NHL game, watching the games on TV, collecting hockey cards, idolizing players like Gordie Howe and Bobby Hull, Bobby Orr. And then fortunately being lucky enough to play in the NHL and talking about Canada Cups and winning Stanley Cups and then, of course, being in LA and then New York and St. Louis. And then sort of me as a fan now watching the games and being part of the Olympics in 02 and winning a gold medal and things like that. So it's just sort of a history of the game itself from sort of different directions of not knowing the beginning part because I wasn't alive, but then as a kid and then as a player and then post being a player, to really how great our game is and how nice the people are in the game. And just fun history of the National Hockey League itself.
What's the process of writing a book
long,
like for you?
Long. And then the process itself, when it's done, that's the beginning, because then you got to go out and people want to talk about it and hear about it, and that's the good thing. But it's a long process. It was almost 2 years of sitting down and coming up with ideas and thoughts and stories. And obviously I'm not a full-fledged writer, but it's my words and my thoughts and my ideas and sort of put them together and collaborate and get them on paper and sort of try to make it flow from beginning to end of what I had sort of envisioned in my mind of what I wanted kids. I wanted kids to kind of pick up the book and say, well, that's pretty cool about the NHL, or well, one day I hope I can play in the NHL. So that was kind of the process.
What a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
That does it for my chat with Wayne Gretzky. To see more of our day with the great one, including him demonstrating the practice routine his dad taught him, go to youtube.com/Graham Bensinger. And if you get a chance, give us a rating and review. Thanks again for listening.